This is the Home Tech Podcast Show, number 23 for April 28th, 2011. Again, a Thursday evening here at the Average Guy Studios, and I've got the guys back, some traveling from afar. Tonight, Christian is back with us from his trip to Argentina. Christian, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm doing well, Jim. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. We'll take a few minutes later on in the podcast to let you kind of talk about your trip, but good to have you back on the podcast, and I hope you had a great week away.
Thanks, Jim.
Do you have a lot of homework to make up when you get back from a trip like that, or is school on break?
Yeah, the school was on break, but I had some afterthoughts to catch up on. So,
yeah.
But of course, my tech projects kind of get their time too. So
right, and of course, Christian runs bios-mods.com. And does somebody take care of that while you're out?
Yes, I had Jason take over as temporary admin for me. A special thanks to him, as well as Alex from Australia and my normal moderation panel. So thanks for keeping that running for me.
Yeah, that's just still crazy. How many hits are you getting on average there daily?
We're still averaging about 2,000 unique hits a day, 60,000 page views a month, and I think we're up to 18,000 members now. So
that's awesome. We don't talk about it enough, but if you ever need your BIOS modded for any reason, or you want to change it in any way, bios-mods.com, and you can reach Christian on Twitter at TheWizBM. I like it. We also have Andrew back. Andrew, welcome to a full show for a change. It seems like you've been in and out and sick last week. I hope you're feeling better tonight.
Yeah, I know. It's been a bit of a week in and out, a couple of weeks in and out, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back, and we'll get you a full show in. We, right before the show, we were talking about how good Skype was and how good it was with all the video and everything was working. And I cursed the show by saying the Skype gods were with us. And everybody said, don't jinx it. And as soon as we did that, we started losing connections. Chris, welcome back. Chris is a good friend of ours, podcasted with me for a lot of months, about a year and a half.
Yeah, that's about right.
Over at the Home Server Show. And he is busy. He's in St. Louis. And working at a hospital there, and has been busy, can't do that anymore, but it's good to have him back on this show. And so, Chris, welcome to the Home Tech Podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, I can still work in the hospital. I just can't podcast as much anymore.
Yeah, that's right. So, Chris, so a lot of the listeners that we have are carryover from the Home Server Show. Give us a little bit of update what you've been up to over the last couple months.
Yeah, so I'm about 9 or 10 months into my pediatric residency at St. Louis Children's Hospital, and taking care of little kids full time. And we kind of change up every month where we're working and what patient population we're dealing with. And right now I'm actually on a fairly light vacation and community clinic month. So I just spent most of the day seeing fairly healthy patients, getting their routine physicals and health checks, and kind of a nice day to see kids that aren't as sick as some of the ones we see in the hospital, and take care of them.
So, kind of a normal job instead of having all the stressful stuff all the time.
Yeah, you know, it's all good. It's all fun and interesting patient care, but sometimes it's nice to see kids that are going to go back to school when you're done seeing them, as opposed to the ones that are going to be staying in the hospital for a while.
So. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, welcome. You
Thanks.
Are at Christopher Lux on Twitter. And
I'm a terrible Twitterer, so don't expect to see me out there too much.
Yeah,
so.
I just imagine you're too busy to tweet.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if after the show you want to send a direct message over to Chris, I'm sure you check that maybe every.
Well, you know, because of the Home Server Show, I about every other day I get an email that says someone new is following you on Twitter, and I don't know where they're coming from, and it must be from listening to old Home Server shows, because there's nothing interesting to read from me.
Well, speaking of old shows, you and I did a fitness tech podcast about 3 months ago when we were first launching it, and talked about the Kinect. So you're kind of a multifaceted guy, and it's always good to have you around. So thanks for joining us today. I am, of course, your host, Jim Collison, and you can reach the show podcast at theaverageguy.tv. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jay Collison. That's good to do just from the sense that I tweet out when the show starts and when we have any show time changes from time to time. We all can't make it at the same time, and so I let folks know. Sometimes, you know, a couple weeks ago we did a doubleheader with the Home Server Show on a Thursday night. We kicked this one off, and we did that one later. And you only know that if you're following me on Twitter or following the blog, TheAverageGuy.tv. www.pediatricresidency.tv. Well, guys, over the last couple of weeks, I've been asking folks to write in and give us their feedback, and we do like to read that on the show. So if you have got something to say, a question to something we say, or a follow-up comment, you can send us an email, and we will read it right here on the show. Let me read this one real quick. This one says, I just heard your home tech podcast about SyncToy. We talked about that towards the end of the show last week, a real popular data transfer tool that all of us have used at one time or another. And I want to share my experience. I have a Windows Home server, and I use SyncToy as part of my cloud backup solution. I have Mozy Unlimited, a Mozy Unlimited account on my desktop, and I sync files from my server to my desktop for offsite backup. The important files are on my Windows Home server. My desktop has an extra 2 terabyte drive installed. SyncToy runs daily to copy over the vital data. That's music, photos, data, iPod compatible videos and such. Which is currently about 650 gig. Mozy then runs to the backup to back up the data that SyncToy just copied over. So a fairly tiered kind of backup strategy using a Windows Home server, an additional drive on a desktop in a desktop environment, and using Mozy. Kristen, did you use Mozy before in the past when we're trying all those backup plans?
No, we did try a whole bunch of them to get some cloud backup. I'm using CrashPlan now. I purchased an unlimited account from them as well. And, you know, it's an interesting thing that he's not running the cloud backup on the home server. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about is why doesn't he just have an extra non-pooled drive in that home server and copy things over there and let Mozy run off of there, unless Mozy doesn't run on the home server for some reason.
I don't know. I don't know if that does or not. Must not.
It gives you a duplicate in a different computer, so I guess if you didn't fry one or the other, you'd still have that data there. But
sure.
I'm not positive why he would do it that way. But I'm sure it works just fine. It's just transferring between one extra computer.
A good way, I think a great way of kind of highlighting the power of SyncToy and being able to move files from one place to another, and then Mozy comes and swoops those up. Mozy does look for changes in those files. So he also goes on to say, my files don't change very often. So after the initial run, which copied over everything, it runs very fast now. Of course, it doesn't copy the new files all the time, only the ones, or I mean, it does, only the ones that have changed. He says, I've used Keep Vault in the past, and I know that they pay the bills at the home server show, which they don't. They're not sponsors, I don't believe. But I had a bad experience with them. I had a plan that the home server show had promoted long ago, offering 150 gig, and I'll move on. I contacted Keep Vault tech support, and they wanted to change. There's some information in there. I'm not sure I'm going to read all the way through that. So in the end, dropped Keep Vault, switched over to Mozy, and that seems to be working well for them. So Michael in Connecticut, thanks for your email on that, and appreciate the feedback on SyncToy. Not maybe a great experience with Keep Vault. I've been having a great experience with Mozy and SyncToy, using SyncToy. One of the things he does mention in the email, of course, is using that the Windows Scheduler, which I've never been a big fan of Windows Scheduler for SyncToy, because you guys know SyncToy doesn't have its own scheduler in it, and that's the one big drawback to SyncToy.
Exactly, yeah. Especially because I've never been very reliant on the Windows Scheduler for anything. I feel like it's kind of convoluted to set things up in the first place, and I never know when things that I schedule are actually going to run or not. I've just never found it reliable. You guys, Christian or Andrew?
Yeah, I tend to do all my backups manually, and my offline stuff manually, so I'm a bit of a heretic, I guess, to that end. Mm. I had a bit of a look at Always Sync after Mike was talking about it last week, but I haven't really thought about putting it into a production uses yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say I kind of go along with what he says. I keep a lot of the sync stuff local. But when SyncToy 2.1 came out, I believe, I did the update to that, and everything still runs the way I expect it to.
Yeah. I used to use Live Mesh for syncing. I used to like Live Mesh a lot for that. I haven't played with that in a long time, though.
Right. Yeah, one of the things I like about the SyncToy is that it's pretty easy to integrate into your task scheduler in Windows. And I've had mixed results with that with some of the older versions, but it seems to have kind of smoothed itself out now. So I primarily use it. We first use it between our two servers when they're syncing backups. But I also use it personally between my desktop and laptop so that any documents I do on one shows up on the other.
Got some comments in the chat from DieHarder that that Windows 7 also has the offline folder syncing. And it sounds like, Andrew, that's one of the things you play with. So you can sync directly with Windows Home Server folders, and you wouldn't necessarily need to have an additional program like SyncToy running. Same thing. I just had an issue today where I tried to have a folder monitor podcast, and it turned on the Windows 7 offline folder syncing, and ran into the same problem where I couldn't get it to turn off. You know, I couldn't get the syncing to turn off, which is not the behavior I wanted. And when I did finally get it to turn off, it asked me to restart my computer. So, you know, lots of weird things. I feel like Windows and Microsoft have a million different ways to sync folders, and none of them are completely straightforward.
Right. And that's always the challenge, isn't it?
Yep.
Finding a method that's consistent in its output. Yeah.
Chris, doesn't CrashPlan have some ability to copy locally or to backup locally as well?
Yeah, so one of the side things you can do, yeah, you can specify a folder on a different computer that you could move things over with. The thing you and I played with, Jim, was you can have a friend where you share storage space. So
right. You
and I could each agree to buy a 2 terabyte hard drive and dedicate it to each other so that we could then have essentially a peer-to-peer cloud between our two computers.
That's dynamite too. I still think that's great.
Yeah, maybe we should do that again.
Yeah, or at least maybe revisit that post and update it and take a look at it. It was particularly advantageous because we both had Windows Home servers that had extra space on them, and so
right. Why
not do an offsite and do it to somebody? I don't have to pay to do offsite then.
Exactly. Let's think about that.
Yeah, and that's part of the free CrashPlan edition, right? That comes without having to buy it. So
yeah.
You would think if a community would bind together, you could probably, and you trust your friends.
Right. Well, but remember the data is all encrypted, so it's all a bunch of random scattered data that doesn't make any sense. So
I wouldn't be so worried about data being stolen as much as that home server being on when I need it.
True.
You know what I'm saying?
True.
Although we're talking version 1 home server here, aren't we? The 2003.
That's what Chris and I did it on. Yeah,
we did not
do that on the new version. I haven't messed with that yet. Maybe that's something to look at. Although I don't know if that'd work. Well, we can take that over to the home server show.
Yeah,
talk about that next week. So, anyways, Michael in Connecticut, thanks for your email. And just to prove, if you send us an email, chances are you'll, or at least right now with me getting one or two a week. You can get that read online, so appreciate it. Something I did mention last night on the home server show, I thought it'd be great tonight to talk about. I don't know about you guys, but it seems like about once a month or every other month or so, I get somebody calls me and says their PC's not working and the hard drives, for whatever, it's done. It's fried, stuck, it's not working. They didn't back it up, right? They never. And,
why would you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't figure out why. They'll never back it up until they need it, right? And then they have to have it that day. A friend of mine's, the hard drive crashed. He didn't have it backed up. He's like, you know, he calls me, is there anything you can do? So he dropped it off at the house. I threw it in. And by the way, I bought this $30 hard drive dock off of Newegg. It's super cheap. USB 3, you can jam any hard drive, any SATA hard drive into it, whether it's
Didn't your wife get you that as a present?
No. Well, yes and no.
She asked me about getting you one of those. And
she bought me one like it, and then I bought my own, and I made her send the one she bought back.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought she was going to get wife points for giving you a geeky present.
I'm an idiot. Anyway, so I bought this dock, USB 3, slammed the drive in. Of course, I wouldn't recognize it. And, I mean, it recognized it, but it wants to format it right away. And, of course, you don't want to format that drive, right? You stop. Ah, wait.
Right.
And so one of the tricks that I used is what I like to call the 6-inch drop. And so I just hold it 6 inches off the table, hold it flat, and I just drop it. And it.
What?
No, hold on. It gets better.
Then you cringe as well, why don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, this is one of those kind of things. It's a last-ditch effort, right? I mean, if you're pretty much sure the drive is shot and you can't do anything with it, you're going to get one more shot at it. This, and we used to do this all the time when I was in PC support and we'd have a drive freeze up. So 6 inches above the table, let her go. It slams on the table. You pick it up. You put it in the drive. And guess what? It spun up and I was able to get the data off of it.
What do you think's happening? Like, what do you think you're actually – are you dislodging the read arm?
I think what happens is the arm gets stuck in a position and it can't move. And so when you do that, you dislodge it. Now, there's lots of things you can do, like drive the head into the spindle. But 9 times out of 10, it works again. Now, you can't – you hurry to get that data off the drive because you have no idea how much longer that drive is going to last. But – I was able to recover – he had about 22,000 files, and I recovered all but 9 of them. And I used SyncToy to pull the data off that file and move it
over. And those 6 files were the ones you scraped off by dropping it on the table.
Yes, spindle drove into the head. One of the things I wanted to ask, which was odd, is he said to me when he gave me the drive, he said, my dad always sticks the hard drive in the freezer and lets it freeze overnight and then pulls it out and plugs it in, and sometimes that works. And I thought, are you kidding me? I'd never heard of that, and then someone else had mentioned it. I heard it twice in one day. Have you guys heard of that or any other tricks to unstick a frozen hard drive or pull data off what seemingly is a drive that you'll never get the data off of again?
Yeah, I tend to use the freezer method, although you need to be pretty sure to put it into a plastic bag so that it doesn't pick up any condensation from the freezer, because that'll toast the drive as well.
All right, so Ziploc will work for you. Put it in a Ziploc
in the bag, suck all the air out of it, and freeze it for a couple of hours. I was telling you the other day on Skype, my parents' laptop crapped itself, and you know, same deal. They'd never done a backup of it. They had all their business data and everything on it, and pulled the drive out, froze it for about an hour and a half in a bag, and pulled it out, and miraculously got all their data off it. So,
Only thing I can think of would be putting it in a different machine. You know, you never know if there's a bad cable or a bad connector or a bad, you know, I/O bus somewhere on the motherboard that you just need to swap it into another machine. But I've never gone to any extremes like freezing or dropping.
Christian, any tricks that you've learned on drives that have gone bad?
Yeah, not with freezing in particular, not if like the actual spinning mechanism freezes, but I've had laptops where the actual people think the hard drive goes bad and it's actually just the motherboard connector for that hard drive, so you would just pop it in an external dock and off you go.
The cable itself has gone bad.
Well, not just the cable, but sometimes the actual port on the motherboard gets shot on the laptop.
Especially SATA drives for some reason.
Right, and also with server drives, especially if you have like 5 of the same exact server drive and one of the logic controllers break, you can swap your logic controller on one of your working hard drives to pull the data off and then put it back on. So that's the actual green part of the chip, the actual chip part you see on your hard drive, and there's a special process to kind of make sure you remove that without breaking the one that works. But if it's the logic controller and not the actual spinning part of the hard drive, that gives you enough time to recover. And I think that's about it, because there's only so much you can do before it gets shot for good. So
yeah,
we've all obviously been burned before, so we all back up.
Yeah, well, that's the most important thing. But those are some tricks, you know, as we try to make this show the tech show from tech guys for tech guys. Those are some nice little tricks that you wouldn't think about, dropping it, freezing it. If you've got any other tricks that you use to get the data back, Chris, appreciate that idea about maybe the cable or the port going bad, and that's why I like this external hard drive port that I've got, because it's a really easy way just to slap a hard drive in and put it on a PC that I know is working. If you've got another method or anything that you've used or tried before that seems crazy, maybe it's electric shock or something that drove it over with your car, send us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, and we'll read that next week on the show. Yeah,
the other one was the application we discussed the other week too. What was it called? PhotoRec, which is the one where it will pull data off your disk even if the disk looks like it's dead.
Oh, okay.
So that when I did the data recovery off that drive, it first came up saying that the drive needed a format, but when you then plug it in, you can do a low-level read off the disk.
All right.
So that that sort of pulls you out of the situation that looks like it's dire, that may not be as dire as it first seems.
So it's a little software.
Yeah.
A little software app to get that done.
Yeah, we discussed that 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Four or five shows ago, yeah.
They all start to blend together.
That's right.
Yeah. The one of the things I wanted to warn you guys about, and I don't know how many of you know this, Google Apps is making a big changeover, especially if you have a domain account with them. So if you had I have the averageguy.tv domain account over there that gives me 50 free email addresses and the ability. We do all our show notes online through using Google Docs, and we actually do real time collaboration with them. Which, God, if you haven't tried it yet, it is absolutely the sweetest thing to be able to watch. I mean, the four of us in real time are changing and editing and almost chatting in a Word document or in a Google Doc. That has big changes coming to it May 10th. And so if you have a Google domain and you haven't upgraded your account, they will automatically upgrade it for you on May 10th. If you don't have an account, the 50 free seats that you get today go away and you'll have to pay $50 a seat from that going forward. So if you own your own domain, whatever that can be, you know, that could be jim.com or chris.com or lux.com. And you haven't set that up yet and you do want to get access, you know, maybe you want chris@lux.com. You can easily do that for free on Google today and get 50 free seats to do that, as well as all the domain document sharing. Starting May 11th, that's going to cost you $50. So you might want to take advantage of that going forward. Chris, you and I were talking about this before the show, and you'd gone out to Google's site. If you go out to google.com/A, that's their app site. They've kind of buried... it used to be right up front to get the free account, and in preparation for this changeover, they've kind of buried that link, and so you kind of got to go looking for it. Let me pull that up 1 second and see. I think you needed to, and I'll have to look that up and maybe just begin the free. No, you don't want to begin the free trial.
It's down the bottom left hand side for the free account one.
Ah, there it is. So it says Solutions Google Apps Free, bottom left-hand corner. Thanks, Andrew, on that. And you click that link, and you can still sign up for one of those free accounts up until May 10th. So if you haven't done that yet and you want to get those, I use it for this show here on theaverageguy.tv. I have an Oracle user group here in the Omaha area called heartlandoug.org, and we use it there. And all the board members are in that domain. It's pretty handy to have. I don't know, Christian, do you guys, you use Google domain apps for anything you guys do?
No, we don't. All the sites that I host that are commercial are through IX Web Hosting, which automatically includes the Horde web client. And I put custom software on there so that if they don't like Horde, they can use whatever else they want. So for me, the Google Apps connection isn't really important, because the main attraction for domain users is email, which is already kind of pre-included. But yeah, if it was something where they wanted live documents or something like that, then I would probably consider it, because it's not, they do make it pretty straightforward to set it up so that your website kind of syncs right into their DNS settings.
Yeah, it's fairly easy to set up. It probably took me half hour, 45 minutes per account to get, or per domain to get everything set up. But once it's set up and you've made the correct settings in your DNS stuff online, it does go pretty easy. If you're new to all that, you might want to find somebody who's registered an account before or is good at that. If, you know, for some of you guys listening, it's probably old hat. So take a peek at that. With that comes some new, you get access to some of the new Google apps that are out there that you haven't had access to before. So I'll be upgrading my accounts this week. And if you have been waiting to do that, you might not want to wait too much longer. All right, Christian, what do you got for us tonight?
All right. So we are going into our deal of the week mode, and I couldn't believe this. Maybe it's been a while since I've shopped for SD cards, but there was a $16 SD card for, you know, for your camera for $20. Is that
16 gig, you mean?
Yeah, 16
gigs. So is that reasonably cheaper than normal, or am I just not keeping up with my prices?
That is cheaper than that's cheaper than like it's a good deal, but you'll see that pretty regularly. Like I see that come up on techbargains.com pretty frequently.
Okay.
Does have a rebate, so it gets it down to $15.
Yeah, the thing to remember about SD cards is that you want to make sure that you're looking at their speed. So this is just a basic secure digital from HP. There's a lot that are designed for higher speeds. So if you've got a nice digital SLR or something that does continuous shooting or particularly video shooting, you want something that's going to be a slightly higher class, so that you can get that video and data transferred as fast as you can to and from the card.
Right.
So this is probably – I don't see the – it's class 4. And I'm actually not real versed in the different classes, but I'm guessing that's not the fastest.
Right.
I think class 4 will give you standard definition video, but if you want to go high definition video, you need to go to class 6.
Yeah,
like 5
that
or
sounds,
6.
That sounds right.
All right, because I see I got a couple SD cards lying around on my desk here, like the Lexar 4 gig. It says 60x. Does anyone know the terminology for what that's referring to?
No. You know, that's one of the biggest things is that the you go into a Best Buy or whatever, and there's just racks and racks and racks of these things, and people typically just buy whatever is the cheapest, whatever is sitting
right
there. You know, so the 60X, I'm looking at Wikipedia, and the, when you look at the classes, 60X is going to be approximately, it's going to be class 10, and that's referring to 66X is the rating for class 10. The class 4, the one you brought up, is 26X. So, you know, it really depends on what you're using it for. If you just want to save some data on it, that's fine.
Right.
But if you're looking to really use it in a high-end piece of equipment, that's probably not going to be the one for you.
Right, because like my camera has an ultra 32 gig that writes at 15 megabytes per second. So I'm sitting here thinking, well, this card doesn't say anything about it being 60x or any x for
that.
Yeah,
32 megabits per second correlates to class four, so it's the same thing that you're looking at. So,
right.
So, and you said this already, right? So the Herney in chat said class 4 is pretty slow. Class 10 is the fastest.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
right.
But there's new classes now, so they don't classify them by classes anymore. But there are some that technically can go up to 600x or 720 megabits per second. Those are at least listed on the Wikipedia page, but they don't have class ratings. So those are probably used by, I don't know, the FBI or something. I don't know what that's for.
Right. Because, I mean, this...
And that's
this,
fast, isn't it?
Yeah. This SanDisk card I bought about a year and a half ago, and it's 32 gigs. It's a 32 gigabyte flash drive, and that was $100-some to buy. So
yeah.
I'm surprised it's rated at a class 4 for that kind of price tag. But then again, SD cards have come down considerably
yeah.
in price from 2 years ago. So, yeah, just kind of checking out the SD cards on the market.
Cool.
So that's that.
And, you know, a little SD thing we could jump on there for a second.
Yeah, do it.
So when we were when there was some CES coverage on the Home Server Show, we talked briefly to people at iFi, which do it's a SD card with a built-in Wi-Fi transmitter so that you can actually transfer the pictures as you take them over your network to a computer, which is a really cool technology. I don't know how they can compress a Wi-Fi into the size of an SD card, but their latest offerings, they've just done a large update where the iFi card can communicate directly with your mobile phone. So if you've got your iPhone in your pocket and it can connect to your camera, so you can take a picture, a high-def picture with your digital SLR and have it instantly transfer to Flickr or have it instantly transfer to your Facebook page, and they can do that on the fly in your pocket.
So is that Bluetooth?
That's pretty cool.
Bluetooth over
you know,
to the
it's,
phone?
They don't really talk about how it does it because there's no Bluetooth built into the card. There's only Wi-Fi, and there's some issues about Wi-Fi is typically not supposed to be able to go. You're not supposed to be able to create a network with the iPhone or other phones. But so I Phi has some proprietary technology, I believe, where they're connecting the card to the phone to transfer that data. But that's not typically a usage scenario that works, and somehow they've figured out how to do it. So
through an app, I'm sure, on the phone.
Yes, you have to have an app running live, but it will copy the data over to the phone and then upload it by the 3G or 4G connection, whatever, to the network. So pretty awesome.
Good stuff. And it uses the phone's 3G then to move that up to Flickr?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, imagine being at a sporting event, right? And you're shooting live sporting events. And within seconds of taking that picture on your digital SLR, it's loaded up to the magazine or to your blog or whatever. It's pretty.
Yeah. Assuming you're not on AT&T, of course, right?
Yeah.
Just kidding. All right, good. Well, you know, I used you guys can't see this if you're listening, but I bought this little SDHC USB. You know, I can just plug the card in and make a little flash drive out of it. So I currently have a little 2 gig in there, but I could easily buy 16 or 32 gig, pull that out, plug it in, and continue to upgrade my flash drive, basically. You got one of those too, Chris?
I was just going to ask, have you ever seen one of these that actually snap in half?
Oh, wow.
So when you snap it in half, the inside is actually the little prongs for USB.
That's crazy.
So you can plug the card itself into a USB slot
and then put
it directly right back into your camera or device.
Now, who'd manufacture
this? This is a SanDisk Ultra 2.
That's cool.
And so actually what I've used this for is I've loaded a slimmed down version of an operating system and installed Windows 7 from this guy. Just putting it into a USB slot. So, yep.
How big is that? I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's 2 gigs.
2 gig. Okay.
So I used that when I was using it on a very small SSD in a net top.
Wow.
So
that'd be nice to have Windows just on a little flash drive that big and fold it in half, throw that in there, and install it.
Size of a postage stamp.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, good stuff, Christian. What else do you got?
Cool. So moving into my kind of feature topic, briefly for the week here, is I had someone on the trip hit the delete all button on their camera, of course, about 60% through the trip. So there went all those great Kodak moments from Argentina. So I said, don't take any more pictures. Chances are it's perfectly recoverable. So this is what prompted the entire SD card discussion. I took his SD card and put it into a program that is made by the same guys who write CC Cleaner, Pinaform. And it's called Recuva, R-E-C-U-V-A.
I'm guessing that's Recover.
Recover, like, Recuva.
You're recovering your files.
I don't know. Kind of like the Recuva, you know, just like the...
Oh, you're hoovering them off the memory card.
Yeah. I like that. So anyway, I thought it was pretty cool because it gives you the quick wizard view and you can specify whether you're just looking for, you know, pictures or videos. And I was able to pull back everything he had shot, probably because I was smart enough to make him not take any more pictures on that card.
And you were the hero.
I was the hero. But just the way it pulls it back up, and then you can just auto-restore for free software that's going into
that
level.
Isn't it?
Christian, you want to explain quickly why that works? Like, so you knew that if you just didn't take another picture, explain why that would work.
Right. So what's happening when you hit your delete button, whether it be on your computer, when you hit empty recycling bin, or when you're hitting delete all photos on your camera, what that means is that it's just telling your device, whatever that device may be, that space is now allocated back to something new. So it's not actually physically destroying the data. It's just saying those sectors of the hard drive that were previously storing your data are now no longer being protected. So basically it's letting your device start to write to those sectors again. So what happens is, let's say you've deleted all your photos and you don't really know about this and you start taking pictures again, or you keep using your operating system. What that camera is going to do, or what that computer is going to do, is it's going to say, okay, the user told me that these sectors are no longer being in use, so I can just go ahead and write new data, and that's when people run into the problem where they can't recover their files.
And that works for full hard drives, too. So if anybody ever deletes a whole big thing and then you empty your recycle bin, they shouldn't be gone right away. So.
Right.
Yeah, true.
especially with, you know, with a camera, it's not really an operating system. It's just writing literally the static picture. So as long as you don't start shooting away another 100 on your SLR, chances are you'll have a 99 or 100% chance of recovery. Now with Windows, there's a couple good practices you want to keep in mind, because Windows is a live operating system, which means you're always writing your page file, and chances are there's a service that's always writing here or there. So the first step is you realize, okay, I've lost a file, I've accidentally deleted it out of the recycling bin. Your first step is to shut down the computer. And what that's going to do is just prevent anything you have open, whether it be internally or something you're doing, it'll keep it from having that probability of being overwritten. Now, the chances are, the bigger the hard drive, the less likely that is to happen, but it's just as probable that Windows decides to reuse those same sectors.
Sure.
So the first thing is go ahead, shut down that computer. Then go ahead and pull out the hard drive and put it into another computer, and then as long as you boot the hard drive as a removable drive and you're not booting off it, you can go onto that computer and run the recovery software from there.
And recover and then, your files.
And recover yep. your files, yeah. But
tomato, tomato. Come on,
tomato,
guys.
Tomato. I know. But he brings up a good point. That's recover. It's recover. But
you're almost saying it like an Aussie now. That's impressive.
But in any event, another thing people want to keep in mind is that some people will go ahead and say, oh, great, this program found all my files, I'm going to be great. And then they go ahead and restore the files to the same exact memory card or USB drive or whatever. So in the process of restoring your files, you're actually probably going to end up deleting them as you destroy them and only get about 50% of what originally showed up.
So don't do it yourself. Give it to your tech friend to do for you.
Pretty much. But yeah, if it's something like, I mean, I've seen a lot of e-using and other programs that had the same kind of horsepower but wanted me to pay $200.
Sure.
This is the first free one that's been in a nice wizard form that, you know, grandma may have a chance of learning in the next couple months. And, if it's something where like you just hit the delete all on your camera and you don't want to have a panic attack, then just go ahead and download Recuva and, you know, select the pictures at wizard and off you go. So
yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting you say where you're saying about the overwriting files and whatnot. I was reading somewhere the other day that there was a photographer, and I can't remember who it was, but one of the blogs that I follow, and this guy was saying that he believes that the memory cards actually have a greater capacity than they designated to do, because he went back and ran a recovery utility against a memory card that he'd been using for a couple of years, and he could go back as far as the original photo that he'd taken on this card and still recover the image. So he was going with the logic that unless it's using all the contiguous space on the card, that you can still pull back a majority of the file.
Weird.
Which I thought that was really curious, because and he actually showed a screenshot, and I'll see if I can find the article.
Yeah.
That, you know, and he'd pulled back about, you know, 500 files off a card that was only capable of holding about 100.
That's really cool and really scary. Sometimes you want to delete your pictures.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't take that sort of picture, but yeah, it's really odd, and I'd love to be able to try it myself, but I need to find the article again to try and throw a memory card in. But I mean, I format my memory cards after I download them, so I don't know if a format makes a difference or not, but be curious to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Christian, can you, you know, one of the things I failed to ask you up front, I was going to ask you to just recap your trip down to Argentina. How'd that go? You said you weren't going to use any tech. Did you really hold to that?
I made it about a good 95% of the trip without using any tech. So
really?
If any of my friends are listening to me, don't rat me out. I think the only time I actually used it was probably the last night when I was posting a blog post up on their site. It was really the only time I caved, but it was 3 o'clock in the morning and I was getting on a plane soon anyway. But I gotta admit, it was probably pretty good for my health, especially because I didn't have to answer any business emails or BIOS mods requests or work on any of my tech projects. But it added to my experience because I spent more time focusing on friends and having fun than being the tech nerd that I always am. So that was cool.
That's good. Good for
had
you.
About, had about 4 days in both Cordoba and Buenos Aires. Had a chance to speak all in Spanish and forget I knew how to speak English.
Really?
As well as, yeah. That was interesting because I...
You know, your talents just have no end, Christian.
How'd you go with the Spanish for the duration?
What do you mean?
Like, did you find that you were having to think back into English?
Yeah,
and then translate it, or did you get to a point where it became that where you were thinking in Spanish as well? Because you've had a couple of weeks down there.
Yeah, it was about a week and a half. It's pretty interesting because I've taken Spanish since I was in fourth grade, so it's kind of been one of those take the class, learn the conjugations, take the quiz, but you never really think that you're gonna have to use it, and then you go on one of these trips and you go, oh wait, yeah, I'm gonna have to use it. So for me, I'm like, I'm probably going to be up a creek without a paddle here. I mean, I can write Spanish fine, but writing and communicating with someone are two completely different things. So, for me, especially in Cordoba, it's just like the United States. You go down south, it's a completely different accent from what it is up north. And that was the same thing I found in Cordoba, where the accent was much heavier than it was in Buenos Aires. But my ear kind of tuned to it, and it probably took me 2.5 days to start speaking fluently on my level, which doesn't mean that it was perfect grammar or anything like that, but it meant that I was holding a conversation for 20-30 minutes. The person knew what I was saying, and I was able to know what they were saying. And surprisingly enough, a lot of the vocab that you study in school does come in handy. So that was kind of an eye opener. Like, don't sleep in Spanish class and do tech projects. But by the time I was back in Buenos Aires that morning, that last morning, I spent with my family before the concert because I have a extended family down in Buenos Aires, and the seven of us were sitting at the table. They all have perfect English, and after 10 minutes of realizing I was understanding their side conversations in Spanish, they would only speak to me in Spanish. So it was like seven people shooting across the table speaking Spanish, and that was a bit of a challenge, but probably an experience that I'll never forget, because now it's kind of, like Andrew said, at first it's like you're thinking about the stuff in English and you're overthinking it. And then, I was telling people on the way back from the trip, I went to go talk to the guy next to me, and I started rambling in Spanish, and he looks up at me and he says, I speak English, right? And I'm like, oh, right, okay. So it was kind of at that point where, even though I wasn't perfect at speaking, I made it the first language instead of English. So that was a lot of fun.
Christian, can you see a time when some of that experience gets potentially changed? So I know that there are groups working on apps and services and things where there's sort of a live translation feature on a phone. And they're testing these things now where you can speak into a phone and designate the output language and just turn and aim the phone to the other person and it will speak in their language. I wonder if there would ever be a time where you would take that device with you and not immerse yourself in the language, not spend the time to be a part of that 8-person round table and speaking just with them.
Right.
Because you'd have a piece of tech that could do it for you and cut that corner.
Yeah, that was what Gene Roddenberry, said 30 years ago was, hey, universal translator, but
would that be a good thing or not? It sounds like it wouldn't necessarily be good.
Yeah, I mean, I took back from there was a cultural experience that nothing else can replace. No piece of technology can replace.
Exactly.
It can't add to my experience with understanding the culture, because if you're speaking in English to someone who speaks Spanish, you're getting, like how people always say there's things that get lost in translation.
For sure.
Sure, you can have a computer perfectly translated, but you can miss a really great joke if you're not trying to immerse yourself in the culture. So obviously if you're back at home and, you know, there's someone who you're really just not getting through to, it would be great to pull it out of your pocket and start talking. But, you know, if it's something that you've been spending years of your life studying, it's, for me, it was important to.
And there's value in that.
Right.
There's value in that.
Yeah.
And you miss inflection as well.
Yeah, exactly.
If you use a device to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So.
It's a great topic, guys. That's, you know, the use of a translator versus the, you know, taking the effort to learn the language and learn the culture. And I think there's a certain amount of respect that you earn in a culture when you jump into it and really make an attempt to speak the language.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, we found that with trips to Japan in the past where, you know, our Japanese, well, my Japanese in particular is terrible. And, you know, even though my sister's a Japanese teacher, but, you know, just having the basics to be able to say, hi, how are you? And, you know, this is a beautiful ski run that I'm about to go down, you know, that type of thing. It's, you do get a whole different, level of response from the people you're talking to.
Yeah. At least, and in some cultures, if you at least make an attempt, they'll let you, and then they'll kick over into English. And
I guess it's just good to remember that you know, sometimes all these great corners that we're cutting can remove you from an important experience. You know, yeah. We've got our video on for the people listening, and we were talking before the show that, you know, Christian plays the violin, and I, you know, don't play so much anymore, but used to play the trumpet, and today a lot of kids learn music by playing Rock Band or playing Guitar Hero, and you know, they're becoming amazing at pushing five buttons on a plastic guitar or on beating on four pads on a drum pad, but that takes away from sort of the longer period of learning and the longer course of education from actually learning how to play a real instrument and read music that's not flashing in colors at you on the screen. So.
Yeah. Well, and Christian, you play violin and a lot of that is touch, right? I mean, it's right. I mean, that's an instrument that's very, very sensitive to touch.
Right.
And so it's not about just smashing your fingers, on the strings. And of course the bow takes quite a bit of finesse as well.
Mm-hmm. And even just a record player took away people's need to play music on their own, you know? So we think like it's all this new stuff, but even back then, I think people stopped playing as much music on their own when they could have records. And now that we have hundreds of thousands of MP3s on our servers, you know, it's easier just to pop in an MP3 on your player than it is to play your own music.
Okay, so. That's my next podcast, the Anti-Tech Podcast.
Nice.
All right, good. Christian, what else do you got for us?
Okay, so let's come back to the technical world for a bit here.
No, that was a good discussion, guys. I appreciate that. That's really good related to tech, so that's good stuff.
Yeah. So let's get back into some Windows 7 diagnostic, because for me it hasn't come up in a while on my network, which I guess is a good thing, seeing as how that means everything must be working. But Event Viewer is kind of an indispensable tool for us all, and I don't know if it's honestly a fair game question to be able to ask your average user to check their Event Viewer. You know, and it can probably fix a lot of the common slow-ups they're having, but A, they don't know it exists, but B, they don't know how to read it. And I've had a lot of things where, you know, you don't really know what's going on until you open up that Event Viewer and you see all the little red critical X's going on. So one of the things I wanted to do was kind of give an introduction to it in hopes that if someone can't figure out why their computer is slower than the molasses in January, then they may be able to have luck with Event Viewer. So if you go ahead to your start menu and you open up Control Panel, you'll be back in your Control Panel for Windows 7. And then if you click, I always set my sort to, I get it out of category view, put it right in the large or small icons, because the category view is enough to confuse anyone. So once you're in large icon view, which is my preference, you'll see about 5-6 down on the left-hand side, performance information and tools. And then that's going to take you to your Windows Experience Index. Go ahead and click Advanced Tools, and then you'll see the second one down says View Performance Details in Event Log. So that's the manual way of getting there. Now, if you if you want to speed that process up a bit, go ahead and hold your Win key plus R. That'll bring up a run dialog, and you can just type EVENTVWR, which is Event Viewer, and hit OK, and that'll bring it right up. So once you're in Event Viewer, you're going to come to a page that says Overview and Summary. Now, depending on the load time on your hard drive, sometimes this does take a while to take up if you have a lot of events. You know, there's some computers that have probably stored over 200,000 events in 1 year. So you're going to see a couple categories. You're going to see the first thing that shows up is on the left-hand pane in your tree view is Windows logs. And these are going to be the five main logs you're going to check to see if anything crazy is going on. So when you're at your overview, you'll see error warning critical. So that's just if you want to see if there's any errors or warnings instantly coming up within the last hour or so, and it'll take you right to that error message. So, for example, my last error message that shows up is Windows mobile-based USB device is plugged in but is unable to make a network connection, which is because, unfortunately, my cord is so degraded I need to buy a new one because it does not sustain a connection. But you'll see those kind of error messages. Now, that one was pretty easy. I was able to read it, and I knew what was going on. But if I, you know, if I go down to some of this other obscure stuff, let's just say here's a recent one from Windows Home Server. It tells me backup on device volume has failed. It gives me a bunch of numbers. I don't really know what's going on. And I'll even get informational messages. The latest one I get for whatever reason is that there's here's a good one, radar pre-leak in WoW 64. And it gives me a bunch of numbers, some files, and I'm sitting here like, well, why do I need to know this? So if the level, there's four different levels in Event Viewer. Your lowest level is information. Chances are if it's information, it's not relevant for your purposes. It's just something the system is logging as part of its Event Viewer, and it's not critical into changing how your PC is running. It's just logging things that are going on. Then if you drop down to warning, obviously that means something is not in its normal operating parameters, but probably isn't too severe. And then you'll see error, which is normally, you know, a program error or a problem with your services. And then I believe critical is reserved for system problems that are, you know, something internal like kernel power failure, anything like that. So I don't want to go rambling through every single error message I've encountered here, but I do want to bring up a good website that can help you learn more information about these kind of complex, I don't understand what these messages are telling me, and turn it into something where you can find your own solution. So if you go to eventid.net, that's EVENTID.net, all one word, that will give you a chance to further read these things in terms of, you know, finding out what program is throwing the error message and making a connection. So let's say we can choose anything. So it doesn't have to be just an error. We can choose anything and see what comes up. So I'm going to go ahead and drop down a system, and I'm going to choose my last thing that says the Win HTTP web proxy has entered the stop state. So I don't know what that means. I don't really care what it means, but I want to find the English translation. So I'm going to look over on my fourth column. It'll say event ID. Now, that number is normally anywhere from 3 to 5 digits long. So in this case, the event ID I see for this information is 7036. So now I'll be able to go to eventid.com or .net and type that event ID number in. So I'll go ahead and type in 7036. And it'll also optionally give you a chance to type in the source or the event source, which is the next one over. So in this case, it says Service Control Manager. And that basically just helps me narrow down the possibility of what it is, because there are several programs that will try and use the same event ID, or Windows will throw the same event ID for a different thing. So if I click that, it gives me the same exact thing I see in Event Viewer for that particular error message. And now if I click comments and information, there's, you know, there are people who are typing in additional information about the problem or the information. Normally, if it's a very common issue, the actual event ID site will post information about it. So in this case, if I drop down to the comments section of what I just looked up, it'll give me a description right from eventid.net, and it tells me this event is recorded for several services when the computer is powered on. The reason for this is that various services may perform certain tasks at startup, and once done, they will stop by themselves. In this case, it's accomplished by the corresponding error, and it tells you everything you need to know. And that was pretty English, so I read the first sentence. It says that it's a regular process when Windows is starting up, so I know it's not something I have to worry about. But if it was something more serious, especially I think the last major Event Viewer discovery I had was with iTunes throwing the Bonjour service error, like no tomorrow, and that was honestly bringing my computer down to its knees. I was able to look up, you know, if I didn't know what Bonjour service is, because there's no relation when you look at it that it's to iTunes, you'll be able to go in and say, okay, now I can go to this site. It'll probably tell me it's related to iTunes. Then I can find out how to disable or fix the problem. And then you're kind of learning the first steps that you need to go from being someone who's an average computer person to someone who knows a couple tips and tricks to start diagnosing some computer issues when your tech guy is away on vacation in Argentina.
You know, Christian, it's a little bit like, I mean, I've always been frustrated by those error codes that just give you nothing. And I hadn't seen this before you brought this up, but this really gives you some actual useful information to work with on those errors.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, it's a site we use a fair bit in the corporate world too. Yeah. You know, often when you Google an event ID error, it throws you out to eventid.net. So it's it comes in really handy, and you can dumb it down to explain to non-tech folk as to what the actual problem is and what we had to do to fix it.
Well, I just love the errors in the system that tell you nothing. And so you're like, what am I supposed to do with that? I mean, what kind of error is that? And how did it, you know? And this again, if you haven't used this before, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Good stuff. All right, Christian, anything else on that?
No, I think that's about it for Christian's Corner.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. Andrew, you've got a few things you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, one of the things that's been fairly big in the news this week is that Yahoo's finally managed to sell off Delicious, which is their bookmarking service.
Did I hear that sold for pretty cheap?
Yeah, it was. I haven't actually seen the dollar figure, but it was bought by the guys who started off working in PayPal and then founded YouTube, who are Chad Hurley and Steve Chen. And they've formed a new company called Avos or Avos or however you pronounce it, avos.com.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to operate the Delicious product under their new banner. And I know Delicious is one of those services that some of the other podcasts that I listen to use to get a bit of listener feedback and, you know, what listeners would like them to talk about or the like. And, you know, thinking that if people wanted to use the tag the average guy in Delicious when they find an article or a product or something they'd like us to discuss, then that's something that we could, you know, bring to the table and, you know, give a bit back to the community who are listening. Because we can then grab an RSS feed out of Delicious that'll show us everything that people are tagging with the average guy.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I've seen that out there, and I'll be honest, that's one of the sites I've never really touched before.
I've never used it either.
Yeah, and Andrew, do you use it much?
I use it a little bit. There used to be a bunch of us at work who used to share bookmarks, and it's a really good bookmark sharing service for that purpose.
Have you tried to use it much?
No, I'm not much for bookmarking services, no.
Well, certainly these guys bought YouTube and then turned around and sold it to Google for some ridiculous amount of money in the billions.
Just shy of just shy of $1.8 billion, I think they got for YouTube.
Yeah, and I think there's a similar play here. Of course, Yahoo has been notorious for mismanaging just about every property that they own. They have an incredible – I mean, they still – I think they're still close to number one on in mail, you know, in email usage, and they've never been able to really capitalize on that as an organization. And they bought this. They probably paid too much for it, and they probably sold it for pennies on the dollar to these guys who will soup it up and probably sell it back to Google as some kind of Google property. So this is one to watch for sure.
Yeah, and I mean – you know, the current Google bookmarking service is okay, and it integrates with, you know, just about every web browser. But if these guys can turn it, you know, would have turned it around into something that, you know, further builds on that style of functionality, you can see that Google would pick it up and run with it as well.
Okay, so if they tag, if on Delicious they tag a site with the tag the average guy, all one word, the average guy. Then those, like Twitter, those would congregate, or I'd be able to do a search on Delicious and find those bookmarks.
Exactly.
Oh, all right. Well, let's try a little experiment then. So, if you're up for this experiment, and I'll jump in on this right after we're done with the show and get an account. I assume I have to have an account on Delicious set up with a username and password. And we'll go in and get some things set up, and then if folks will go out and bookmark some things. Andrew, what would be things they would make, might want us to talk about in next week's show? Would that be?
Yeah, for argument's sake, if someone wanted us to talk about a particular type of dock, you know, maybe like an IC dock, two-bay module or something like that, they can tag that in Delicious using the tag the average guy.
Jim, and Jim, you'll appreciate if you search for the average guy right now on Delicious, the number one response is ergonomic office desks. With 111 responses. So
really?
Maybe you can refine that a little bit.
So let's see. If it's not the average guy, what if we chose – can we use theaverageguy.tv or can we use theaverageguy.tv?
You can use pretty much whatever you choose as the tag. So, I mean, I tagged the website last night, theaverageguy.tv, as a bit of an experiment using the tag theaverageguy as one word.
Okay.
I see.
And that is now currently the only tag that's showing as the average guy in Delicious.
Chris, but did you put the space average space guy?
Well, it did the typical like search thing where it split them all into individual words, and that's where I got the office ergonomics. Well,
let's try it. So if you're out there and you're listening either live or recorded, go out and find it. If something you want us to cover next week. Try the average guy. Let's see if that's, and then I'll see if it's the average user. If I can go out and find those things, and I'll see, I get a little bit of user experience on it. The average guy, or do the average guy TV? Maybe do both. That would be all in word. The average guy TV. Let's just see what shows up, and we'll give it a little experiment. See what appears, and you can tag things, and we'll talk about it next week's show. How's that sound?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Cool. Well, that sounds kind of fun. Andrew, you dropped some was that humor in the show notes for us?
Or for the show? that was just for you guys.
All right.
You know, along the lines of what you find in Google search when you're looking for something and it doesn't particularly come up. So the one that I found, which came up in comixt.com, which is just one of the feeds I follow for those who can't see our notes, is they've searched for Droid in Google Images, and it's come up with a whole bunch of, you know, Motorola Droid phones, and then there's a Stormtrooper underneath. These are not the droids you're looking for. So I'll throw that into the show notes as well.
That'll be good. I like that. Yeah, good enough. All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. Is that everything you wanted to get?
Yeah. The other one was that Google Docs finally have a native Android application. So,
oh yeah.
For those of us who are using it, it works fantastically. I've got it loaded on mine, and I put most of my notes in that we're using tonight directly from the handheld device while I was watching the television last night.
Really?
So it works really, really nicely.
I was downloading that just before the show, and then I got busy and I got distracted. I'll have to give that a try. Certainly, since we're using that all the time, full time now, nice for us just to be able, if I think of something, I can just fire up the apps, log in, and update the notes. That's kind of cool. Hey, one quick before we move on to Chris, I know he's got a couple things you wanted to cover. A little bit of a retraction. So, Andrew, you had put in the notes. So, post this goes back to the Google Apps or having a domain account on Google Apps. 10 users for the free edition post May 10th. So I had said it starts at $50 at the first user. So it's going to go from 50 to 10. So you get 50 today, 10 after May 10th. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the standard edition, which is what most people are using as their free Google Applications domain account, is up to 10 users for nothing, okay. And then it's $50 per user thereafter.
And even 10's pretty good if you've got a small organization or group.
Yeah, if it's just small organization or if it's your family, I mean, you know, we use it for our personal family domain and we've got 3 accounts in it. So it's still bang on and you still get access to Google Docs and YouTube and Blogger and all the other Google services that you can link to the Google Apps domain. So for us, that's still perfect.
Cool. Well, I appreciate that that update on that. I had that wrong and appreciate the filling that stuff in so you can still go out there and get 10. But still, if you want the 50, do it before the 10th if you feel like you're going to build a big group.
That's right, because they're saying at the moment if you've already signed up and you've got the 50 user account, then they'll honor that ongoing.
Yeah. I imagine there's going to be a mad rush, a mad land rush for folks going out and getting the 50 before they switch it over. So
Check
it out. Chris, what do you got for us tonight? What'd you like to cover?
I guess the two things that kind of fit the category here. One is that they've been announcing in the news today that Hulu Plus is going to be coming to Xbox tomorrow, actually. So,
oh, really?
On Friday.
Do I have to have a gold account or whatever?
Most certainly, yes. Okay. I don't know that for sure, but I everything that they do kind of requires that to do online things, so I would suspect so.
Okay.
And that will work natively with Kinect. They just updated the Netflix app on the Xbox so that you can do your hand gestures and your voice commands and things with Netflix, and that works great. You know, you just start up a Netflix movie and you can tell it to pause and go do something else and come back and play it just by speaking to it. And it's going to do all of that with Hulu. And the neat thing that they're doing as a promotion is they're giving everyone, I think it's a week of free Hulu Plus. So everyone that has Xbox Kinect is going to be able to have access to all of their content for a week just to give you a taste. So they're counting on people liking it enough to keep using it. So
do you find that you're a Hulu – do you watch a lot on Hulu?
I don't, but – I'm going to have to play with it. You know, the reason I don't is typically I just record things on the Media Center. But, you know, as more and more things are in Netflix, I've been watching them there. And one example of something I used just recently on Hulu was I missed an episode of Fringe. So with all of the terrible weather, St. Louis got hit badly last week with a tornado that tore up our airport. And so, you know, it's a very small minor casualty from this, but the recording I was trying to watch was just all news coverage of the tornadoes. And so I didn't get that episode of the show. I went back and was able to watch it on Hulu just fine. So that was a pretty neat aspect.
Oh, cool.
Hulu is like a streaming video service, yeah?
It is, yeah. It's Hulu is basically all of the major networks putting their television shows there. It was initially, I think it was it NBC that started it, I think, and then a couple of the other groups kind of joined in and said, yeah, we're not going to be able to crush Hulu, so let's just kind of buy into it. And there's a free version that does a bunch of shows, and then there's some premium things that you can get more access to. And it's like $8 a month, I think, for their premium service. And, you know, if you're not doing cable, a combination of over-the-air HD, Netflix, and maybe plus or minus Hulu Plus would be a pretty complete package to get, you know, a lot of good movies and television content.
$8 a month is pretty reasonable, isn't it?
It's not bad, yeah.
And Chris, is there only Hulu Plus, or is there a free version that's just Hulu?
There is a free version that's just Hulu, but that's not going to work with the Xbox, is my understanding. So again, it's, you know, it's kind of the same thing with a lot of the way Xbox works, that they want you to like to pay for that extra service, and realistically, it's not that much more to get access to. So for me, I think it'll be worth it to try. Certainly the free week, and then I'll consider signing up for that if it works out really well.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. That's Hulu. I haven't been attracted to Hulu at all, and I don't know why. It just doesn't. I've landed pretty much on over the air HD, and we're watching a lot of network stuff. And I get, you know, I have the basic cable, so I get TLC and TBS and WGN. That's about it.
Okay.
And we're perfectly content with that. And that doesn't work for everybody, but
right.
That works for us.
And I've been thrilled to be off of cable. It's been a really nice thing to be spending a significantly less amount of money on entertainment.
Yeah, I pay less than $20 for my cable to get those, you know, to get the local channels plus those three. So it's about 27.
Right. But most people spend a whole lot more.
Yeah,
than that,
the next package up is 55. So yeah. You know, it's another $35.
$600 a year.
Right. Right. So yeah, good stuff. All right, what else you got?
Oh, yeah. So the other thing I was going to mention was a little toy. I got this a while back, but I thought it was worth mentioning. So I got a Pantone Huey Pro. Anybody know what that is?
Mm-mm. Sounds like a helicopter.
Yeah. So it's not a helicopter. It's actually a monitor calibration tool. So I've got a setup on my computer with two monitors. I bet a couple of you guys have this too, where you have more than one monitor on your system.
Oh yeah,
and absolutely. They're different brands. And so sometimes I would have a desktop background up on both screens, and they'd look drastically different. You know, the one would look really green, one would look really red, and you'd never notice it if it was just one monitor. But with two, it makes a difference. And yeah. Once I started doing more media center stuff and using an HD TV as a monitor, I decided, you know, I'm going to look into these a little more. And I found a good deal on one of these. They typically run about $99 to $100. I think I got it for half of that or less. And you basically plug it into a USB. It runs through a whole series of colors. You actually suction cup it to your screen, which is a little bit scary the first time you do it. It cycles through the colors and detects each color and adjusts it. And then it shows you the before and after, and it's a dramatic difference. Often when you look at the corrected version, at first it just looks horribly off because it's so different from what you saw before. But then you leave it that way for a couple of days, and it's just so much better than you'd had in the first place. And particularly if you've got a home theater PC, I think it's worth considering, because you can spend a lot of time trying to calibrate your television with the television remote or messing with the video card and trying to get the calibration done there. There's so many levels at which you can do calibration, and this takes it to the end where it looks at the actual output coming out on the screen and adjusts the brightness and intensity as well as each color balance. So anybody that's ever looked at their screen and been bothered by the image quality or wished it could be better but didn't know how to do it themselves, this is a pretty good way to get it done. So, and there's other companies that do these. Pantone seems to be the lesser expensive. There's a series of devices called Spider. I'm not sure who makes those. But it's a three-pronged looking spidery creature that sticks on your monitor. The same technology, basically. But bottom line, it's a neat way to really take your viewing quality to the next level.
And consistency is always a good thing too. I mean, I run two Pro Series HP monitors, and I took forever to calibrate them so they're the same.
Right, right.
And even now, you know, from time to time, they do change.
The fun thing, too, is you don't have to have it plugged in all the time. So Andrew, I could come over to your house, and we could run it on your two monitors and get them calibrated, and I could take my device home, and they would still be calibrated. So cool. you send me a ticket to come out to Australia, and I'll come calibrate
your monitor. That's like the perfect geek tool, right? Hey, feed me dinner, and I'll calibrate your TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Now, unfortunately, it wouldn't work if you didn't have a PC hooked up to your TV, so all of your friends have to have home theater PCs before that's helpful, but... I like the way you think, Jim.
Well, I'm just saying.
All right.
Just saying.
But yeah, that's pretty much what I got. Just a couple couple little tidbits for the week.
Well, excellent. Well, guys, we've kind of come to the end. It always goes so fast, but I appreciate you guys' input on this. I do want to throw one more thing in just a few minutes ago and leave it to the Google Apps team. So as we were talking, no kidding, I got an email. And it said, hello, we recently announced an upcoming change to the maximum number of users in your Google Apps account. So how funny that we were just sitting here talking about that. And while we were talking about, I got an email from the Google Apps team telling me that my number of accounts are going to stay the same, and lo and behold, the new accounts will require, or well, you can add up to 10 more users on accounts past May 10th. So thanks to Google for sending me that email on a timely basis. It's a little late. You know, an interesting one more thing on that. This I've been working with a friend on another project, and we bought a new URL for it, and I wanted to create a new domain account. And that's kind of what got this whole domain interest sparked back up. And when I went in to log in and get it, and no, it's not clockblocking.com, but it could be. By the way, go to clockblocking.com. We think it's pretty funny. But when I got there, it told me the account was taken. And I thought, wait a minute, how did I get this? How could I purchase the URL for it and it be taken on Google? They would have had to have proven that they own the URL. So I guess at one point in time, someone else owned that URL that we bought, and it must have gotten recycled back into the process. So I had to email Google, Google support, and said, hey, I own this now. Can you please delete the other account? And they said, we'll prove it. Right. So I went in and I changed. Christian, what would I change?
Records, say name records, something like that. Yeah.
Name records. And right. Like for Google Webmaster Tools, they make you, there's a couple things you can do. You can bind it to your analytics account, and then that's like your, becomes your unique ID when you use Webmaster Tools. But the one they used to originally have before they had all that fancy stuff was they would put, they would make you upload a file to your FTP, and then it would confirm the file and the encryption key was there. That had always been the model for the last 2-3 years. Then they started, you know, if you already have an analytics account on the site, webmasters will just check to see if the code is there and running, and if it is, then you're already confirmed in our network.
Yeah, in this case, I added an MX record, and it was ghs.gallup.google.com. Listen to me. I guess you know where I work. So so ghs.google.com, and saved it, and then sent an email off to him and said, okay, check it. And they verified it right on the spot and said, okay, you're indeed the owner of the URL. We're going to send a note to the owners, to the admin of that account. They have 3 days to claim it and to prove they own it, which they couldn't do because I owned it at that point. And so today I sent a note and said, what's going on? And they said, we'll let you know tomorrow. And if it's not taken care of by then, they're going to flush the cache basically.
Which
resets the account back to zero, and I can started up. So I thought that was kind of cool. Google support, you don't think of Google as having a support desk all the time, but they were actually very helpful and said 3 days, and it was 3 days. And I'm hoping to have that account ready to go and up and running tomorrow. So good job, Google. That was nice. So, all right, guys, sorry for that little tangent. I want to let folks know if they want to email the show. Again, I've said it a couple times, but podcast@theaverageguy.tv. You can find us in iTunes. If you'd like, just search for the Home Tech Podcast. It's a ways down, but you can find it. There are RSS links, and there is an iTunes link right on theaverageguy.tv. If you want to do it the lazy way, I've got a link. You can just click on it, and it'll automatically add it to your iTunes library. And, of course, you can join us on Facebook. The whole network is out there. You just type in search, The Average Guy Network, and I've got a site there that will update you whenever I post an update. So that's the way to do things. Guys, we'll do it again next week. Chris, we'll try and get you back in the rotation here in maybe 6 to 7 weeks and see if we can have you back on the show.
Sounds good. This was fun.
Willing to join us? Yeah, no, very good. We'll do it all over again next week. And till then, we'll see you. See you, guys.
Have a good one.